Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Get in a car in glittering Shanghai, China, where the personal income is surging, where the newspapers regularly keep track of the latest billionaire, where high school students score the highest in the world in math, science, and languages, and drive about 900 miles southwest, and you find yourself in Guizhou, a city that does not glitter, and where the biggest issue in the high school and elementary schools is malnutrition at levels that affect developing brains. These are the two Chinas in 2013. But get in a car in rundown, poverty-stricken Bridgeport, Connecticut, here in the U.S., where the dropout rate is one of the highest in the United States, where the state has had to take over the schools they are so low-performing, where the tax base has eroded to the point that basic services in Bridgeport are spotty and the unemployment rate is well over 12%. Get in a car in Bridgeport and drive just 29 miles southwest, and you find yourself in glittering Greenwich, Connecticut, where the local paper chronicles the social calendar of billionaires, who's going to Harvard and Yale, and where the big news is how the local hedge funds are faring. These are the two Americas in 2013. The online news service Global Post decided to deeply chronicle this two worlds phenomenon in a special report, The Great Divide, Global Income Inequality and Its Cost. Two correspondents from that report join us now, Michael Moran, author and foreign affairs columnist, and Kathleen McLaughlin, files for the Global Post. Both of these reporters file for the Global Post. Michael and Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
So I'd like both of you to describe where you decided to explore this two worlds phenomenon, this income inequality. Michael, you chose Bridgeport. Why?
Well, Bridgeport is kind of prototypical city of my generation. I was born in 62, so I'm at the end of the baby boom. I was born just outside of Newark, New Jersey, actually, which is a very similar, slightly larger city with very similar problems. Bridgeport was a place I ended up living on the outskirts of in high school. And so I knew that of all the places I had ever lived, Bridgeport was the one that was the most starkly disconnected from its wealthy suburban neighbors. And it seemed to me that this was not unusual. But we came across the fact that the Gini coefficient, which is a measurement of inequality in any metropolitan area or country or state, rated Fairfield County, Connecticut, about as bad as, for instance, Bangkok, Thailand. And so, in essence, we thought we would start looking across the United States and find places where there were these kind of correlations with shocking developing world emerging cities, where you might expect there to be a great deal of inequality because, this is the tooth and claw early stages of capitalism in some places. But for the 21st century in Fairfield County, which everybody else thinks of as a kind of gold coast, it's pretty shocking to find that it is one of the most unequal counties in the country.
Well, let's listen to the voice of Charlie Coviello, who's a Bridgeport resident, who spoke with you, Michael, on how Bridgeport has really slid in the last several decades.
Bridgeport at one time, back in the 50s and 60s, was a very rich community because it had manufacturing, it had jobs. You could walk out one door after getting fired in the morning and get a job in the afternoon across the street. Today, that doesn't exist.
And the people of Bridgeport think, nostalgically about an economic boom that is probably never coming back to Bridgeport. Kathleen McLaughlin, you, because you work in China, looked at urban areas and communities inside those urban areas that also embrace this income inequality. Where did you focus?
Exactly. Well, for my report from Beijing, I mean, what you described is very accurate, that you can see this immense wealth in the cities like Beijing and Shanghai. And if you go to places like Guizhou, you see crushing poverty still in pockets. But there are places in cities like Beijing where you can go to a single neighborhood and see both. And so I went to what might be the most stark example in China, which is a street called Jinbaojie, which means the street of heavenly treasures. And on that street, you can find cars that sell for almost $1 million, imported Italian sports cars. And at the same time, you can find people who are making $100 a month cleaning up the trash. These are migrant workers who come from rural, poor farming towns who try to make a better life in Beijing, you know, looking for a better income, looking for a better life for their families. And oftentimes they get trapped in a cycle of poverty as well. So really, for me, it was interesting to focus on this one single street because it's all right there in the middle of the Chinese capital.
Tell us a story, both of you, of how this income inequality manifested itself in what you saw as you went back to Bridgeport and focused on these neighborhoods in Beijing. And then and analyze, if you will, is this luck of the draw or is this a way society is organized that is a sort of a takeaway from this report where we need to really rethink our civic institutions in China and in the United States and around the world? Michael?
Well, again, I think it's less shocking in China, which is at the beginning of the stages of development, if you want to call them that, of capitalism. But to go to Bridgeport, really the story is not Bridgeport per se. It's the Bridgeport metropolitan area, which includes all of Fairfield County. The story is not that there's urban poverty. We know there's urban poverty. There has been since 1910, going back into the 1800s. What's unusual is that statistics now show that during a period roughly starting in the mid-70s, it's the middle-class people in these towns like Norwalk and Stamford and Fairfield who stagnated. Even though their wives joined the workforce, even though they became more productive, their incomes fell or at best kind of stayed the same. While, you know, the upper 1% of incomes, according to the Congressional Budget Office in that same period, has gone from having 10% of American wealth to 20%, which is where it was in 1910. I mean, this is when Jacob Riis was taking pictures of the slums of New York. So there's something wrong there. Something's happened to whatever steps were taken, the great experiment of changing the tax structure so that the rich would get more money, they would create economic activity, this would trickle down. Clearly the activity happened, the U.S. economy grew, the trickle down did not happen, the middle class stagnated or fell, and that wealth ended up absorbed by the top 20% of our income strata.
Well, Kathleen, China wasn't ruled by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. It was Deng Xiaoping who set in motion the forces that produced this inequality. How would you analyze it, and what stories did you see?
Well, it's interesting you bring up Deng Xiaoping because he is well known for kind of opening the doors to private wealth in China. And he has this famous saying that goes back several times where he talked about some people needed to get rich before others did. So there was always this kind of tacit agreement that certain people would get rich before everyone did. And I think that for a long time, most Chinese people during the modern era, during the past 30 years, kind of bought into this idea that, well, that's okay if that person is getting wealthy because maybe I can do the same thing. What has happened in the last 10 years or so, and interestingly enough, the Chinese government during this last month has, for the first time in 12 years, actually released its own measure of the Gini coefficient. It's been such a sensitive topic that they haven't even released it for 12 years. But what has happened is you've seen a shift in people now going, looking at who has accumulated the wealth. And it tends to be, at least the perception, that the people who have accumulated the wealth have political ties, have friends in government, are in the government, have family in government. And so maybe this kind of Chinese dream is not attainable for everyone.
For both of you, is this Global Post report really a story of the failure of this dream, whether we call it trickle down in the United States, whether it's a Gini dream in China, a failure of this capitalist notion that if you're an entrepreneur, if you work hard, there's a shot that you could make it. And these stories say is, in fact, that is a cruel hoax. And there are forces in place that will prevent that from ever happening to most of the people who are at the bottom. Michael?
Well, I think that what you're seeing in China versus the United States is a country that started grappling with capitalism in 1978 versus one that started in 1776. We went through our let's call it Chinese phase of capitalism, where the great wealth was accumulated by the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the et cetera, the railroad magnates. And that period, we thought, had ended with the crash of 1929. There were reforms that broadened the tax base, but also began to give people at the lower rungs kind of these ladders into the upper rungs of society. These things like VA loans, things like, a gradually more progressive tax rate. But these things became unraveled in the early 80s, thinking that we could try something new. And I think the results are in now. So today, it's a lot harder to move in American society than it was 20 to 30 to 40 years ago.
Kathleen, why don't you give us some final thoughts here, both on your experience in China and your just sense globally of what's going on here?
Well, China has a two-tiered system for people who come from rural areas and people who are born in urban areas. And it's incredibly difficult to ever move up economically if you're born in the countryside and try to move into a city. And that hasn't changed. And there's been very little signal that it will change. And so what essentially they've created is a whole class of citizens who are unable to move up. I mean, there are lots of stories of people in China who do manage to break into wealth, you know, through hard work and everything else. But if you're one of these people, these migrant workers who comes into Beijing with the wrong paperwork, you're never going to move into a different income bracket. And so it's almost to me more comparable as to looking at immigrants coming into the U.S. from another country. That's the kind of situation that you see in cities like Beijing. And the question will be, I guess, for China moving forward is how are they going to, this we're talking about a group of 230 million people in this category, and it will be growing as this country urbanizes. So how is China going to manage that problem and grow alongside that problem as they modernize further and try and take this capitalist experiment that they've got going further into the global economy? And it's going to be interesting and delicate, I'd say, a very delicate balance for them to make.
If not terrifying, 230 million people in that low income bracket. That exceeds perhaps the population of the entire United States. Kafka economics, you might call this being stuck in the middle class or the lower rungs of society, watching the billionaires move forward. Michael Moran, author and foreign affairs correspondent for the Global Post. Thanks so much. Kathleen McLaughlin is based in China. She files for Global Post as well. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is The Takeaway. Explore the Great Divide and give us your reaction to it at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us.